Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Andy McSmith. Andy is a lobby journalist who worked for many years for national newspapers and has also written a parliamentary novel, biographies, and a history of Russian art under Stalin. In his new book, Strange People I've Known and Other Stories, Andy shares his personal encounters with the great and the good of the British political landscape, revealing what they are really like behind the scenes. Today, we want to chat about some of Andy's encounters with political giants, media titans, and some other strange people and tales featured in the book. Hello, Andy. Great to have you on this episode of Bite Back Chats Books.
Yeah, nice to be with you now.
And we're very excited about your new book, Strange People I Have Known and Other Stories, which is coming out in May. So the name of your book, The Strange People I've Known, do you think politics and power attract strange people? And if so, why?
Well, certainly the politicians we see, i.e. the House of Commons, it certainly does attract people of a certain kind, because just to get there, you've got to put your name forward, you've got to go in front of selection meetings, a whole load of selection meetings to get selected as a candidate. Then as a candidate, you've got to walk around the street shaking hands with complete strangers and telling them who you are. And most people don't want to put themselves through that. So only a certain type will get into Parliament. But there are a lot, you know, the range of people who are prepared to do that is very great. I don't like this modern sort of clever idea that all politicians are in it for themselves, or they're all crooked. I know MPs who are genuinely want to do good, and are genuinely not treading their own nest and are trying their best. And yet, I'm afraid there are also others who are just totally egomaniacs. But they are all people with pretty tough hides.
Yes.
Now, the other type who get into politics, the ones who don't see, who are behind the scenes. And some of them are a bit weird too. They can be people who just completely immerse themselves in this hobby that they turn into a profession, who I'm afraid sometimes rather love the idea that they can tell other people how to live their lives without being in direct communication with them. So they get stuck into some campaign or other, or they become advisors or special advisors. Some of those people are a bit odd too. But again, and you know, I know special advisors and people who work with parties who are very nice, normal people.
I suppose that sort of alludes to Dominic Cummings' blog, where he was trying to hire the strangest or the weirdest people out there towards this the special advisor profession.
Well, it takes one to know one. Dominic Cummings is one of the weirdest people I ever met. I didn't like him. And I feel that he is a guy who just loves the idea that he can direct other people's lives, pull us out of the EU. He would love doing that. And I'm sure it made him feel important, but he's not, clearly not an easy guy to work with.
So you followed many people as a journalist, as you were a journalist from a young age. Who's been the most fascinating person to follow in that time?
Well, it probably tends to be the way that the ones meet first seem more interesting than the ones who come later.
Yes.
So of all the professionals I met, I mean, none of them intrigued me more than Thatcher.
Okay.
Not to say that I was an unqualified admirer of Thatcher, because before I came to London, I was living up in Newcastle, where you saw factories being closed and men in their 50s were the only breadwinners for their family, thrown out of work with no prospect they're ever going to work again. So I came down here without thinking that she was necessarily a force for good, but she was a fascinating person to deal with. She had an intellectual confidence that other prime ministers lack. She was the last prime minister who would walk into a room full of journalists without having to have an advisor at her side to protect her and stop the conversation when it got difficult. because she was totally competent. And, you know, I once found myself in an aeroplane going across what was then the Soviet Union, now called Russia, and we were talking about dissidents who were locked up in labor camps.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was nothing in it for Thatcher. There were no votes there. But I mentioned the name of a guy and no, she was trying to remember the name of somebody, and I suggested it was a man named Bukowski, and she got cross at me because she would never forget the name Bukowski because he was such a famous dissident. It was somebody not quite famous. So famous. You can't imagine having a conversation like that with any other prime minister since, because there were no votes in it. It was just a subject that interested her, which she was confident enough to talk about.
Mm. And you were in that position as a lobby journalist, correct?
That's right.
For those who don't know what exactly that is, could you just give us a brief outline of how it used to work and then sort of what it's morphed into now?
Yeah, actually, it's easier to answer the second question first.
Yeah.
In order to get into the House, to the House of Parliament, you have to have a pass.
And
there are different kinds of passes. And the type of pass you have determines which bits of the building you're allowed to go in. And a lobby journalist is simply a journalist who holds a particular kind of lobby pass that allows him or her to wander about parts. Certain parts of the building won't allow, but doesn't allow them to go into the library, for instance.
Yes.
But they can go into the corridors and the cafes and talk to MPs. So that's what it means now. The name lobby is derived from a particular part of the building, which is the central, not the central lobby, I beg your pardon, it's just called the lobby or the members lobby. If you ever go into the Commons as a visitor, the first place you arrive in is the central lobby, which is a huge room, reception room. You may then head towards the debating chamber. If you do that, on your way, you pass through another lobby where there are life-size statues of Churchill, Attlee, Lloyd George and Thatcher, and that is the lobby or members' lobby. And the rules are that when the House is sitting, nobody's allowed to stop and hold a conversation in that room except MPs, members of the House of Lords, and lobby journalists, hence the name lobby. And that used to be an enormously valuable privilege. Because when I first started, there were no daytime news programs. Nobody had mobile phones. Nobody texted anybody. There was no email. So if you wanted to talk to an MP, you either had to ring their office as if they were in, or the best way was to stand in the lobby and catch them as they went by. And it could be, I mean, it was during that week when Thatcher was fighting for survival and was brought down.
Yeah.
That place, I was absolutely stuffed full of politicians and journalists trying to find out what was going on. And I remember, you know, as I was quite a junior journalist, and also I was working for a paper that wasn't for the Daily Mirror, which was not most Tories' favourite newspapers. A Tory MP came up to me and stood in front of me and said, "Do you mind if I talk to you for a few minutes?" So I said, "No, I don't mind." He said, what is it? And he explained that he left his coat on a bench at the edge of the room, and between him and his coat was Michael Heseltine, who was running against Thatcher, who was therefore lobbying every MP he could grab hold of. This guy didn't want to be lobbied by Michael Heseltine, so he just wanted to wait until Heseltine moved so he could go and grab his coat.
Yeah.
In the meantime, he wanted to talk to me. Mm. That's what it was like, but it's not like that. I mean, now you go into lobby and it's empty because everybody talks around. And there's a big new cafe called Portcullis Cafe, which is always very busy. And also, if you want to catch a quote, if you're a journalist and need a quick quote from an MP, you might just as well turn on the rolling news and there's probably somebody being interviewed out on the green. So it's not, the lobby is nothing like what it used to be.
So do you think, I suspect there was a level of competition between the lobby journalists for the main newspapers, or was there more of a level of camaraderie, do you think?
I was surprised when I went in there, because I had an unusual career project. I went straight from the lobby, straight from the Labour Party press office
into yes.
the lobby. And it seemed to me that while the Labour Party apparatus was run on the principle of free enterprise, in which nobody seemed to cooperate with anybody, I was quite taken by the level of quiet cooperation between lobby journalists. If there's something, bits of news that's going around and everybody knows it except one person, there's no great advantage to everybody else if that one person is then landed in trouble.
Yes.
So unless the person concerned is particularly unpopular, their colleagues will rescue them.
Mm.
And that happened to me just after I joined. It must have been a Sunday, because I was on my own in the Daily Mirror office.
Yeah.
And there was almost nothing happening. And I was thinking, what on earth am I going to do? And a guy from the Daily Mail just walked in and said, oh, Andy, this is what I'm writing. This is what the Daily Express is doing. This is what the Sun is doing. And then off he went. And of course, a minute later, the news desk ringed me to say what's going on. And I'm able to give them this list. Well, there's this possibility. We could write this or this or this or this. And they think, well, this guy in the, with the new guy in the lobby is good. I was bailed out by a colleague.
I mean, you mentioned lots of interesting stories in the book, in and around Westminster. A particular favourite of mine is one of Romola Christofferson and Norman Fowler. Could you just give us an outline of that story?
Well, Romola was a civil servant, and he was a very interesting civil servant. She was very different from the average one, and she was very good at her job.
Mm.
And she was taken into the Department of Health as their head of communications during the AIDS crisis.
In the 1980s.
In the 1980s.
Yeah.
Now, when AIDS first hit the public, I mean, when it first arrived, first of all, it was seen as only a problem for gay men.
Mm.
People didn't believe that the heterosexual population could get AIDS, which was false, though it was principally gay men who were dying in great numbers. But also there was this puritanical notion that, you know, if men indulged in that sort of thing, then that was their problem, and it was not really for the government to do anything about it. Now, by about 1986, that mood was changing, and Norman Fowler, when he came in as Secretary of State for Health, to his great credit, took the view that the government's role was to try and save lives, not to lecture people on their sexual habits. And he hired Romola. He brought Romola in, which was a very good appointment. And Romola was even more told the same view, but she was even prepared to go places no elected politician was thought of going at that time. Her view was that there was no point in pussyfooting around. You had to tell people exactly what you meant.
Yes.
So if you're going to say that unprotected anal sex was dangerous, you had to call it by that name. You couldn't. There was no way of getting around it. And she also didn't hold to the idea that it was only gay men who needed to know about this, and wanted advertisements in places like the Sunday Times, whereas, you know, Thatcher's view was you could stick a notice in a men's loo, but not where nice people were going to read it. And she fought that battle and made Norman Fowler go in to see Thatcher and tell her that they were going to put out information with this very, very explicit stuff on it. Mm. Now, I was told a wonderful story about Romola while she was still in office, and I was so intrigued by it that I made her promise that as soon as she retired, she would agree to be interviewed by me so I could check whether this story was true.
Yeah.
And the story went that she was in a group where she was the only woman in the room, and they were presented with a piece of literature which had the words oral sex on it. And according to the tale I was told, Norman Fowler looked at this and then said, excuse me, what's oral sex? And of course, Rommel, he couldn't pronounce his R's very well, so he probably came out at all. What's oral sex? And everybody looked at Rommel. And Rommel, as the only woman in the room, had to explain to the Secretary of State for Health what oral sex meant.
Oh, brilliant.
Whereupon, Norman Fowler's reaction was, crikey. Now, I tested this one with Romola, and she said, well, no, that wasn't quite true.
Yeah.
First of all, she said it wasn't. If she, in the end, she didn't have to explain what oral sex was. It was the chief medical officer who had to tell everybody.
God, yeah.
But she did say that Norman Fowler said, crikey.
Yeah.
But I then asked Norman Fowler whether it was true that he didn't know what oral sex was, and he said, oh, no, of course he knew. He said the reason he said crikey was because he was thinking that he'd have to go and explain all this to Margaret Thatcher. So there you go. But it was a great tale.
That's a great tale, yeah. And working on Fleet Street must have been exciting in this time. Can you tell us any, you worked for Robert Maxwell as the press officer.
Yes.
Can you tell, there's one particular instance with him that is rather interesting.
Well, now, first of all, I want to say I didn't want to work for Maxwell as a press officer. He just told the editor of the Daily Mirror, send me a journalist to work me as a press officer. And they knew that I'd done that sort of work for the Labour Party. So I was simply shoved into this, and I managed to get out of it after a couple of months because I hated it.
Yeah.
But it took me ages just to get into Maxwell's office to be interviewed by him.
Mm.
And then when I finally got in there, he couldn't think of anything to say. So he said, I'm going to introduce you to everybody who works on this floor.
Yeah.
So we walked across this enormous office of his, and he opened the door at one end. And I have to say, when Maxwell entered the room, he was such a terrifying figure.
Mm.
He would enter the room, everybody would freeze and sort of sit there looking unhappy. So he opened the room, there were three women secretaries in the next room, and they all froze. And Maxwell's thinking, he's got to introduce them, but he can't remember who they are. So he pointed at one of them and said, what's your name? And she gave a name. And then he turned to me and said, that's so-and-so. And then, what's your name? Three of them are. And he went to the room, and the first time he finally got somebody, spotted somebody he knew, was when we went into a meeting, and there was a rather nice-looking guy chairing it. And Ron Maxwell was able to point at him and say, that's Ian Maxwell, who's his own son. So he got that right. But a day or two later, I was in a lift and we were going to a meeting. There were three people in the lift. There was Robert Maxwell, and there was me, and there was Maxwell's youngest son, Kevin Maxwell.
Mm.
And Maxwell was still thinking he ought to introduce me to people. So he pointed at Kevin Maxwell and said, that's Ian Maxwell. Of course, I forgot it. And Maxwell said, you just didn't contradict him. Without thinking, I said, no, it's not. It's Kevin. And the old man just sort of looked at me. Then he thought, oh, yeah, he's right. And said nothing else. But Kevin looked furious that his father should get his name right.
You would be.
Yeah.
You've met quite a few successful and then unsuccessful politicians. From sort of meeting them and getting to know them, or are there any telling signs or qualities that indicate the fate of an individual?
Well, you can usually tell when somebody's going to be good. I can't pretend. The only person I ever knew who became a prime minister, who I thought was going to become a prime minister, was Gordon Brown. But that's just because when I went to meet him, I was told by Peter Mandelson, you're going to meet a future prime minister. The first time I saw Thatcher, she was giving a speech to a nearly empty room as a cabinet minister, and I thought that she was competent. I can't say that I thought, I don't mention it in the book, but I did actually meet Theresa May when she was a candidate in a by-election and talked to her for a long time. I can't remember anything about the conversation other than coming away thinking, that she's pretty good. And again, with Blair, you sort of knew he was good because these people have got they're articulate and in command of the subject and quick-witted.
Yeah.
And then there are others you find who are just so ambitious that you know they're going to get somewhere.
I was thinking when you sort of speak about Cameron and that he could talk in a friendly and open manner with you without giving anything away. Do you think that was Cameron?
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, that was because in just after the 1997 election, when everything went bad for the Tory party, I was told that there were people who had hoped to be Tory politicians but just given up on it.
Yeah.
And I was given a few names. One of the names was this guy named David Cameron, who'd been a special advisor and had gone off to work at Carlton Television as director of communications.
Yeah.
So I rang him up to see whether he would tell me that he had given up all hope of being a politician, and talked to him for a long time. I took 3 or 4 pages of shorthand notes as he was talking. The conversation ended, and I thought, what actually has that guy told me?
Yeah.
And I read these notes, and there was just nothing that I could actually get hold of that would tell me, give me a yes or no answer. And that is actually a considerable skill.
Yes.
To be able to talk fluently to an inquiring journalist for a long time and not give anything away.
Mm.
Another master of that art was Peter Mandelson. He could talk and tell you nothing.
Mm. and then you also speak about Johnson when you saw him, bumped into him on a deadline. That's quite an amusing story. Could you tell our listeners that one?
Oh, when he commissioned me to write a piece for Specky.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Well, I thought that was rather sharp, actually, because I was just wandering through the Commons and just under
the
Big Ben.
2000s?
Yes, it would have been 2000, probably 2002, actually.
Yeah, okay.
And there's a place underneath Big Ben where you can park your bike, and in came Boris Johnson, who was then
editor.
Yes, he'd just been elected MP for Henley.
Yeah,
but he was supposed to give up the editorship of the Spectator because he was an MP, but he was still holding on to it. So he was in this position where he hadn't actually got. He'd got some empty, at least one empty page in his magazine, and it was getting near deadline. He was obviously in a bit of a tight spot. And he sees me, and suddenly he's plonked in front of me, interrogating me. No, come on. What? Come on. Come on. Think of something. And I just said at the top, would you do something rather weird happened? A left-wing friend of mine told me the other day they were sending their children to private school. He said, oh, do that. Quite. And instantly he commissioned this piece on why do my left-wing friends send their children to private school, which you can still find on the web. And it was just done on the hoof while he's standing there with his helmet in his hand and his bike clips still on. And then, of course, once it was done, off he went and got on with something else. So he was a sharp operator. I mean, all this, he used to have this sort of faux buffoon sort of act that he put on. But no one should ever be fooled behind it. There was a very, very sharp, calculating mind underneath that sort of Worcesterish exterior.
Absolutely. One sort of frivolous question at the end. If you could have lunch with three people mentioned in the book, who would it be and why?
Right. Okay. I think it's very sad that Tony Blair is remembered now principally for that terrible mistake he made in getting involved in the Iraq War.
Yeah.
I mean, we've just been celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland.
I think it's
a shame that Blair can't be remembered for the immense role he played in ending that civil war in Northern Ireland. But anyway, he's not going to be. But he had considerable diplomatic skills, and he was able to get unionists and Republicans together to talk to each other. So I'd like to sit him down for dinner with Margaret Thatcher, and Edward Heath.
Yeah.
Because you may know that Edward Heath never forgave Thatcher for having the presumption to run against him for the Tory party leadership and to beat him. So he had a bloody woman running the Tory party when it should have been him.
Yes.
And for years he sat there like a sort of towering, glaring presence on the bench, loathing her but refusing to leave Parliament. And I was at a dinner with him once in 1998. And remember, the feud began in 1975. And somebody said to Ted Heath, Ted, when did you last speak to Margaret Thatcher? I last spoke to Margaret Thatcher on the 16th of January. And we're thinking, right, this is only October, that's only 8-9 months ago. It's like, 1976. He hadn't spoken to her for 22 years.
Oh,
so what I'd love to know is whether Blair could bring the same skills that he managed to get Ian Paisley and and Sinn Féin to one room, to get those two to speak to each other. I bet he couldn't, but it'd be worth it'd be lovely to watch.
Yeah, good telly. that's a great answer. Well, thank you, Andy, so much for coming on the podcast today. And your book, Strange People I Have Known and Other Stories, is out on the 11th of May. Very soon. Very exciting. Thank you, Andy. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. Strange People I Have Known and Other Stories is out on the 11th of May. Head to the Bite Back website to use exclusive 20% off code STRANGE20. And whilst you're there, look ahead to some of our other exciting upcoming releases. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with any questions or queries at BiteBackPod.